shower. It means presenting oneself to others. The web provides a place like we've never seen before. We may still have to behave properly in committee meetings, but increasingly, the real work of the corporation is getting done by quirky individuals who meet on the web. Net the 2-hour committee meeting down to 2 lines, one of which is obscene and the other wickedly funny, and then, in a language and rhythm unique to them, move ahead faster than the speed of management. The memo is dead. Long live email. The corporate newsletter is dead. Long live racks of zines from individuals who do not speak for the corporation. Bland, safe relationships with customers are dead. Long live customer support reps who are willing to get as pissed off at their own company as the angry customer is. We are so desperate to have our voices back that we are willing to leap into the void. We embrace the web, not knowing what it is, but hoping that it will burn the org chart, if not the organization, down to the ground. Released from the gray flannel handcuffs, we say anything, curse like sailors, rhyme like bad poets, flame against our own values, just for the pure delight of having a voice. And when the thrill of hearing ourselves speak again wears off, we will begin to build a new world. That is what the web is for. Make a bonfire of your reputations. John J. Chapman. When I was asked to make this address, I wondered what I had to say to you boys who are graduating, and I think I have one thing to say. If you wish to be useful, never take a course that will silence you. Refuse to learn anything that implies collusion, whether it be a clerkship or a curacy, a legal fee or a post in a university. Retain the power of speech, no matter what other power you may lose. If you can take this course, and in so far as you take it, you will bless this country. Insofar as you depart from this course, you become dampers, mutes, and hooded executioners. As a practical matter, a mere failure to speak out upon occasions where no opinion is asked or expected of you, and when the utterance of an uncalled-for suspicion is odious, will often hold you to a concurrence in palpable iniquity. Try to raise a voice that will be heard from here to Albany, and watch what comes forward to shut off the sound. It is not a German sergeant, nor a Russian officer of the precinct. It is a note from a friend of your father's offering you a place in his office. This is your warning from the secret police. Why, if any of you young gentlemen have a mind to make himself heard a mile off, you must make a bonfire of your reputations and a close enemy of most men who would wish you well. I have seen 10 years of young men who rush out into the world with their messages, and when they find how deaf the world is, they think they must save their strength and wait. They believe that after a while they will be able to get up on some little eminence from which they can make themselves heard. In a few years, reasons one of them, I shall have gained a standing, and then I will use my powers for good. Next year comes, and with it a strange discovery. The man has lost his horizon of thought. His ambition has evaporated. He has nothing to say. I give you this one rule of conduct. Do what you will, but speak out always. Be shunned, be hated, be ridiculed, be scared, be in doubt, but don't be gagged. The time of trial is always. Now is the appointed time. Commencement Address to the Graduating Class, Hobart College, 1900. Chapter 3. Talk is Cheap, by Rick Levine. The voice emerges literally from the body as a representation of our inner world. It carries our experience from the past, our hopes and fears for the future, and the emotional resonance of the moment. If it carries none of these, it must be a masked voice, and having muted the voice, anyone listening knows intuitively we are not all there. David White, The Heart Aroused. Voices from Pots. I'm a potter's kid. When I was growing up, we always had red-brown carpet and rugs to help hide the terracotta dust we tracked home from Dad's shop. I have fond memories of watching Italian potters with doorway-wide shoulders spin clay into forms larger than myself, effortlessly raising planters, lamps, bowls, and jars from undistinguished lumps of mud, one after the other, parading dozens of seemingly identical forms across the studio floor. Whenever I see a large, thrown shape, I remember the first time I tried to throw 25 pounds of clay, thinking I would start with less than the 60 or 70 pounds I saw growing like graceful mushrooms on my dad's wheels. I landed flat on my back, shoulder blades bruised, smelling 20 years of clay dust on the wood floor beneath my head, as the misshapen lump of clay took advantage of my first indecision, knocking me from the wheel and covering the studio wall in red mud. You can't learn to throw large forms without losing lots of them in the process. Pots are made by people. Large ones especially remind me of that human authorship. Smaller things, mugs, cups, pitchers, touch me as well. They're fitted to a potter's hands, reflecting their measure. I can gauge the size of the artisan's hands, the length of their fingers, from lips, spouts, and pulled handles. There's so much more life invested in a thrown piece than in anonymous cast or stamped ware. A medium such as clay, elevated and transformed by human shaping, bears witness to the life that molded it into something more than plain stuff. When experienced potters describe their craft, they often talk about seeing the form they're creating in their mind's eye, applying force to make the spinning clay match its virtual internal archetype. There's an incredible amount of practice, failure, and learning that has to take place before we develop the courage and surety to trust such an internal, private muse, to ignore the contrary opinions of others and do what we know will succeed. Despite too many years spent behind keyboards and display screens building software, creating websites, and generally using technology more than is good for me, I'm still a potter's kid. I consider myself an artist and a craftsman, and bring a craftsman's attitudes to my work and life. One perspective that seems to surface with some regularity is a deeply instilled obligation to do new work, create stuff people have never seen before. It's a peculiar approach to life, picked up mostly by osmosis at some early age from my parents and relatives. In execution, it's a standard requiring constant exploration and reinvention, but also a certain studied ignorance of what's considered right and proper. There's a bit of irrationality in believing that if I follow my own intuition and, at some level, don't pay attention to what other people think, I'll create unique works that will surprise and delight. Artists have a stubborn faith in their ability to create newness from next to nothing. This faith shapes their work, enables them to establish themselves as individuals, fingerprinting their way through their medium. What's this got to do with business, with organizations? Lots. Most of the creative people and knowledge workers organizations depend on, those whose sense of self-worth is centered in the pride they take in the work of their heads and hands, will have an immediate been-there-done-that reaction to this description of artistic identity. From the electronic pressroom gang, to the MIS boiler room toilers, to the hackers building an insurance entitlement management app to increase next year's sales, all have some of the attitude of the craftsman. People in high tech take pride in their work. They are individuals who see the details of the things they produce in the light of the trials and triumphs they experience while creating products. In the courage of creation, they find a place to hang their individuality. Programmers and technotypes appreciate elegant, spare code and the occasional well-turned architectural hack. My accountant friends get off on clever spreadsheet macros and on being able to slant this quarter's results to shade meaning within the arcane constraints of the law. Even managers leave their telltale fingerprints on their jobs, the well-coached team rising to unexpected heights, or the business relationship blossoming into a long-term sales annuity. Some people apply a craftsman-like care to their work, and their voices are heard, remarked upon, and recognized as uniquely theirs. The web is no different. Every web page we see has a person behind it. Sometimes their individual decisions are eroded and digested by being passed through a corporate colon of editors, gatekeepers, and other factota, but there are clear signposts to individual care and concern on much of today's web. While all print and broadcast media have at least some indirect personal authorship, there's a key difference on the web. The percentage of raw content published, direct from a creator's fingers to our eyes, is much higher than in traditional media. The web's low cost of entry to publishers, both small and large, and the amount of unfiltered chat, newsgroup, email text finding its way into search engines guarantees our daily browsing experience has a very strong flavor of individual authorship. Inevitably, our heightened awareness of distinct, individual voices engenders the urge to talk back, to engage, to converse. The software and mechanisms developed helter-skelter for the net cater to these urges. Chat, free email, automatic homepages all reinforce our feeling that not only is it easy to enter into discourse with others, but also that we're by God entitled to wade into the conversational stream. Heaven help you if you get in my way or try to stifle my voice. Claude Levi Strauss, the French anthropologist, discusses bricolage as the opportunism of those who work with their hands, creating stuff out of whatever is lying about. The web is group bricolage. Individuals build it without working from a master plan. They take pieces that work, stealing GIFs, formats, links, and create new pages. This makes the web unpredictable, creative, and always the result of human hands. David Weinberger. The good or bad news, depending on your perspective, is that it's hard to fake your end of one of these conversations. Ever been on the phone with a friend or coworker while sitting in front of a computer and trying to read or respond to email when your wire addiction gets the better of you? I'm very good at multitasking and can fool many folks some of the time, but I get caught more often than I'll admit. By my wife, for instance, every time. We can tell when someone is engaged, listening, responding honestly, and with his or her full faculties. We're wired to interpret subtle clues telling us whether a person is all there, if we're the center of their attention, if we're being heard. No matter how starved for detail our communication channel, our brains manage to get a gestalt reading on the other party's presence. Rick may believe he's good at multitasking, but I don't believe it. Humans can't multitask. We can't pay attention to two things simultaneously. You can multitask? Fine. Then read a book and write one at the same time. No, multitasking is really just rapid attention switching, and that'd be a useful skill, except it takes us a second or two to engage in the new situation we've graced with our focus. So the sum total of attention is actually decreased as we multitask. Slicing your attention, in other words, is less like slicing potatoes than like slicing plums. You always lose some of the juice. David Weinberger. In the same way we distinguish personal attention from inattention, we can tell the difference between a commercial pitch and words that come when someone's life animates their message. Try snipping paragraphs of text from press releases and a few pieces of printed person-to-person email. Shuffle the paper slips. Hand the pile to your office mate, your spouse, or your next-door neighbor. Can they sort them? Of course they can, in short order. People channel from their hearts directly to their words. That's voice. It comes of focus, attention, caring, connection, and honesty of purpose. It is not commercially motivated, isn't talk with a vested interest. Talk is cheap. The value of our voices is beyond mere words. The human voice reaches directly into our beings and touches our spirits. Voice is how we can tell the difference between people, committees, and bots. An email written by one person bears the tool marks of their thought processes. Email might be employee to employee, customer to customer, or employee to customer, but in each case it's person to person. Voice, or its lack, is how we tell what's worth reading and what's not. Much of what passes for communication from companies to customers is washed and diluted so many times by the successive editing and tuning done by each company gatekeeper that the live person hints are lost. Authenticity, honesty, and personal voice underlie much of what's successful on the web. Its egalitarian nature is engendering a renaissance in personal publishing. We of genus Homo are wired to respond to each other's noise and commotion, to the rich, multimodal deluge of data each of us broadcasts as we wade through life. The web gives us an opportunity to escape from the bounds imposed by broadcast media's one-to-many notions of publishing. Nascent web publishing efforts have their genesis in a burning need to say something, but their ultimate success comes from people wanting to listen, needing to hear each other's voices, and answering in kind. Wired conversations. The message here isn't new and isn't particularly complex. Our elevator pitch is a pretty short one. People talk to each other in open, straightforward conversations, inside and outside organizations. The inside and outside conversations are connecting. We have no choice but to participate in them. If there's any newness, it's in how the net and the web change the balance of the conversational equation. Technology is putting a sharper, more urgent point on the importance of conversation. Conversations are moving faster, touching more people, and bridging greater distances than we're used to. Let's take a tour of the various conversational modalities the net offers and how they carry our voices. Email. Electronic mail is the wedge cracking the rock of corporate communication. I write a message, label it with yourname@whereveryouare.com, click the send button, and you've got my mail. Most corporate electronic defenses pass it right through. They might screen out applets, viruses, and other denizens of the internetworked dark, but words slip through like wraiths. Thoughts, ideas, kudos, complaints, jokes. We exchange the mundane, day-to-day electronic utterances greasing our business down its intended path. We also trade other missives, possibly words my management would rather I didn't speak or didn't hear. But the flow can't be stopped, not without choking off the lifeblood of most businesses. The inexpedient comes with the expedient, and we have no choice but to work with it. The basic operating rule of email is that anyone can send mail to almost anyone else. All they need is an address. Email is a more immediate medium than paper. My expectation of the response time to many messages I send is today, not tomorrow or a week from now. This urgency means I'm more apt to write quickly and conversationally when I respond to a message. A lot of the spontaneity in email messages comes from writers breaking through their natural caution and reserve, rushing the writing process, giving themselves permission to be blunt, honest, and sincere in response to a query. It's not just a question of knowing how to type, but of giving myself permission to truly converse, to out myself in a conversational medium that is informal, honest, yet open to myriad misrepresentations if I choose words and phrases carelessly. Despite this scary thought, most people don't find person-to-person email daunting. The ease and directness of email is forging new connections, new conversations, throughout virtually every business. Type, click, deliver. Mailing lists. Mailing lists come in two basic flavors, one-way and two-way. One-way lists let me send to a large number of people at once, but recipients can't respond to the entire list the message was sent to. There's no opportunity for conversation other than between you, the recipient, and me, the list owner. These lists can often have the character of a mass mailing, like a Christmas card list. If the mailing is from someone you don't know who's trying to sell you something, convince you of something, or lure you to a particular website, it's called spam. There's a fascinating subgenus of the one-way list called a webzine or an e-zine, as in electronic magazine. These are periodic bouts of creative journalism sent to willing subscribers, with audiences ranging from dozens to hundreds of thousands. To their devotees, they have all the interest and attraction of their well-funded offline counterparts. However, they're often more focused, more idiosyncratic, and less plastic. They're usually created in someone's garage or bedroom office as a labor of love, given a pulpit by the incredibly low entry cost of internet publishing. They may start out like the Utney Reader or Mother Jones magazine, but the web relieves them of the need to raise capital, rent a press, and pay for postage. Many zines have a strong conversational tone. They mine the incoming stream of responses to take the temperature of their constituencies and relay tasty bits back to their audiences. The conversation this engenders often feels like publishing with a more immediate feedback loop. Two-way lists are even more interesting from a conversational viewpoint. They let recipients respond to messages, and everyone else on the list sees their responses. But it takes time to wade through all the traffic on a busy list, sifting value from chaff, knowledge from data. As individual mailing lists grow from small, focused forums, they can easily turn into large, unwieldy free-for-alls. The commitment required to understand the content and context of a list before you post to it is part of the conversational ante this aspect of the net requires. Just like voice conversations, these asynchronous exchanges reveal if you're all there, focused and paying attention. In a moderated two-way list, all mail to the list is screened by someone doing gatekeeper duty. The moderator's role ranges from that of a friendly guide to being an editor with absolute control over every message sent to the list. Moderators often end up having a great deal of influence on the tenor and substance of list conversations. Conversations on two-way lists look just like conversations in personal email, except the odds of having several people responding independently to the same piece of mail go way up. The conversation may branch, spawn side discussions, and loop back on itself as each new person throws in her or his 2 cents. Newsgroups. Newsgroups are similar to mailing lists, except messages collect on special computers on the internet configured as news servers. A business can also have news servers for internal company discussions not available on the public internet. I can point a newsreader at the server to check in when I want to, rather than seeing all the messages accumulate in my email inbox willy-nilly. Newsgroups can be either moderated or unmoderated, just like mailing lists. Newsgroups also record the conversational thread structure of their messages, unlike email, so you can see who is talking to whom and why. The information space encompassed by publicly available newsgroups, called Usenet, is enormous. Every month, millions of conversations across the globe are enabled by newsgroups. Where email conversations are often between people who know one another, Usenet exchanges are often between strangers. It's a medium that encourages discourse and can create a kind of community among its participants. All of these channels for conversation, email, mailing lists, newsgroups, begin to look more alike as you use them. At some point, you start paying more attention to the messages and conversations and less to the differences in software and tools employed by the various electronic delivery channels. For our purposes, the biggest difference between electronic and paper mail is the ease with which a single message can be distributed to a vast audience and then serve as a seed for conversation. I can forward your mail to my friends, to lots of my friends, to lots of people I've never met before, but who might be very interested in what you have to say about your company's management, policies, or practices. I can do this on a scale far exceeding paper distribution, and I can do it before lunch. Here's a real-life example of how a conversation ignores the boundaries between companies and their customers. It starts with a posting to a newsgroup for Saturn car owners, rec.autos.makers.saturn, an entirely reasonable question about how much service should cost and how much control a car owner has over what gets done to his car. This newsgroup isn't owned or in any way managed by Saturn. It's just plain folks talking about their cars. I've shortened this sequence from its original length of about 20 messages and edited individual messages to save us some reading time. I've also disguised people's names and email addresses to protect their privacy. Subject: Am I getting effed by my Saturn dealer? Date: 1999-06-29. Author: Ross. I would like to hear you all's opinion and experiences. I got a 99 SC2 with now 17K. My owner's manual says at 9K and 15K, all it needs is an oil change. At 9K, I got charged $50, and they tacked on a 9K service card that says oil change, top off fluids, check and adjust tires, check all lights in and out, inspect brakes, inspect throttle linkage, lube door and hood hinges. At 15K, I got charged $113, and they tacked on a 15K service card that says oil change, top off fluids, check and adjust tires, check all lights in and out, inspect brakes, inspect throttle linkage, lube door and hood hinges, inspect cooling system, clean engine, test onboard computer, report tire wear. Now, I recognize that doing that kind of work requires some payment, but all I was expecting them to do, and me to pay for, was only an oil change. What gives? At what point of ownership do I get what service Saturn requires as opposed to what my Saturn dealer requires, and why is there a difference? Comments are most appreciated, especially from the techs. Thanks, Ross. Someone chimes in about how much similar service costs them, customers of two vendors comparing notes from the comfort of their home or office. Subject: Re: Am I getting effed by my Saturn dealer? Date: 1999-06-29. Author: Ranger XXX. Where are you taking your car for service? Those prices sound high. At the store I go, the 9K and 15K are just oil changes, and the charge is less than $27. I'd shop around other nearby Saturn stores and see what they charge. Then, some tips for getting along with your car dealer, reference information and advice, a testimonial in support of Saturn dealers. Subject: Re: Am I getting effed by my Saturn dealer? Date: 1999-06-29. Author: Eric. You do have the right to bring your car in at any of these intervals and request that only an oil change be done. If that's what you requested and that's not what they did, then I would have a discussion with the service manager and just tell him that you requested only an oil change, you know they recommended more work but didn't want that, and see what they say. Every service manager I've talked to in about 8 different shops has always been very helpful and appreciates it when these things are brought to their attention. Eric. So far so good, but here's a pointer to another car dealer's service price list. If I were a slightly shady service manager, I'd worry, as my customers have gone beyond anecdotal comparisons to posting real prices. Now it's harder to lie with a straight face. And exposure isn't limited to the dozen or so people who posted to this discussion, but extends to thousands who might search for Saturn customer service and find this thread. Subject: Re: Am I getting effed by my Saturn dealer? date 1999-06-29, author Al. Russ, here is the URL for the retailers in Columbus, Ohio, and what they recommend. It has additions to what the owner's handbook says, but they typically let me choose to do or not to do the extra items. Hope this helps. Al. Some comic relief from the peanut gallery. Subject, re, am I getting effed by my Saturn dealer? Date, 1999-06-29. Author, new, XXX. You were had. Sue, sue, sue. More disgruntlement. No one from the dealership being flamed answered this post. Some readers will assume this omission validates the indictment of Saturn's service and the company will lose business. Further, since Saturn corporate minions didn't wade into the discussion at this point, Saturn may have lost some prospective customers. Subject, re, am I getting effed by my Saturn dealer? Date, 1999-06-30. Author, leaks. Midtown Saturn in Toronto does the same thing, $177 for the 60,000 km service. When I pointed out to the service rep that the Saturn manual didn't call for coolant change, etc., they had to check with service manager, only to agree to not change coolant, as if car owners' words are not to be trusted. When I picked up the car, instead of charging me for the usual $30 oil change, they simply subtracted the cost of coolant change, $90, from $177, and they also charged me half an hour labor for inspecting vibrating brakes and noisy steering, which was supposed to be covered under warranty. The end result was a $145 oil change, and the car was washed but not clean, as there were many dusty missed spots. To add insult to injury, they won't drive me to pick up the car because I arranged the pickup only with the driver, not the service rep. So add another $25 cab ride. Even though Saturn makes good cars for the price and sales reps are nice, some dealer's service department needs to catch up to the rest of the corporation. I'll never go to Toronto Midtown Saturn again and encourage everyone else to boycott them. I'm buying another car in 18 months. Wife and I each get new cars every 3 years. This bad experience will certainly be a factor. It's too bad other nice Saturn dealers will lose out because of this one dealer. Now, a different sort of animal. This is a response from a Saturn employee, a technician, explaining how the game is played. This is an after-hours posting from a real person and may or may not have been sanctioned by Saturn. This represents the firewall bleed-through at the heart of the Clutrain manifesto. Honest comments from employees, unfiltered, going directly to customers. Subject, re, am I getting effed by my Saturn dealer? Date, 1999-06-30. Author, Blue XXX. It's late for me after a 12-hour Saturn day, but I will give a brief answer. If you want a real detailed answer, feel free to ask more questions. Saturn Corp. issues its recommended services and intervals. For warranty purposes, these are all you need to follow as far as maintenance goes. Saturn dealers, on the other hand, are free to amend them in pretty much whatever way they want, intervals and price included. I have worked at two different dealers. My current one is much smaller and the prices are much cheaper. There is a $15 difference in labor rate and the dealers are only 1.5 hours apart. The items included in each service are somewhat different, but not as drastic as yours. I have seen dealers include an alignment with every 12K. I have seen cooling services done at 24K, lots of variations. I don't personally like it because when you get cars from other dealers, they are out of sync. I asked Saturn Corp. why they don't mandate a stricter policy towards service intervals. They said it's illegal for them to force a dealer to do that. I hope this helps a little. Feel free to ask any question you have. I personally agree that what happened to you sucks. Our dealer, the 9K and 15K, are oil changes at about $22. And in this case, our net fairy godmother has the last word. Truth, justice, and a testimonial to the power of the net. Right. Subject, re, am I getting effed by my Saturn dealer? Update. Date, 1999-07-14. Author, Ross. My Saturn dealer agreed I was getting effed, and, quote, in an effort to earn your trust, we extend a free 18K service, unquote. So I took them up on it and spoke to the guy in charge, since he didn't respond to my email. He said that the dealer is, quote, rethinking its 15K service. I guess between these posts and my response to Saturn's 15K service inquiry, they got the message. So I guess I'm almost even, and at 21K will ask for a simple oil change. Ross. This conversation wasn't simply a business correspondence. It was among lots of people, ordinary folks. These people are writing in their own voices because they want to talk, to help, to contribute. If it's not altruism, it's something close to it, with maybe an occasional touch of revenge. We listen to their voices to decide whom to trust, and we can come to some pretty accurate conclusions about who's on the mark and who's full of hot air. There's even overt comic relief and some entertainment. We listen carefully to what wasn't said and who didn't participate in the conversation. The Saturn dealers are conspicuous by their absence. Their silence speaks as loudly as their words might have had they joined in. The Saturn mechanic was speaking for his company in a new way, honestly, openly, probably without his boss's explicit sanction. He gave away secrets, took a risk, was humanized, and he greatly served the interests of Saturn. He and others like him are changing the way Saturn supports its customers, and Saturn corporate might not even know it's happening. This puts a completely different spin on talk is cheap. The mechanic's email didn't cost Saturn a nickel. He wrote it on his own time. Companies need to harness this sort of caring and let its viral enthusiasm be communicated in employees' own voices. Pay a little, get a lot. Talk is cheap. Technology is making these conversational needles lots easier to find in the internet haystack. There are search services anyone can use to find this stuff. General-purpose newsgroup searchers like Deja.com keep conversations like these online for varying lengths of time, some for a very long time. The internet has a wonderfully retentive memory, and we're constantly working to make it easier to retrieve little-used trivia from its magnetic depths. Don't bet against customers' ability to type your organization's equivalent of lousy Saturn customer service into their favorite search engine and see your latest ugly truth displayed on their computer screen. And they'll chime in and tell their story, your story. Chat. Chat gets a bad rap. The Web Canard says all chat sessions degenerate into conversations about sex within 5 minutes. It ain't so. Because it is immediate, taking place in real time, chat can enable conversation that feels more genuine, more substantial, and more human than any other net channel. The aspect of chat that still amazes me is that it can compress distance, enabling globe-spanning conversation in a visceral, obvious way. Email can connect people over the same distances, but it doesn't trigger the sense of wonder I experience when I see words appearing on my screen typed live by someone half a world away. Here's a snippet of chat conversation between two friends. The chat session was set up following an international artists' workshop held in Tbilisi, Georgia, and ran for several months. Belt is in London, Annie in Tbilisi. Belt, just entered the room. Belt, hello, is anyone there? Belt, it's Belt here, waiting for a full gas bottle so I can get warm. Annie, just entered the room. Belt, drinking tea, wondering how to make a living. London transport has just gone up, again. £3.80 for a travel card now. Don't know how people manage it. Annie, 50 tetri in Tbilisi, hey? Belt, crazy. What do you think of the euro and custard pies? Annie, I guess there's no difference in some way. Is it cold in London? Belt, well, it's not so cold, just dark. How about there? Are you still snowed in? Annie, what's that about? Over here it's snowstorms, deep snow, plows, the airport's shut down. Belt, will you be able to get back? Annie, spending time face up to snowflakes, lying in bed of white sparkly comfort, making snow angels. Have you ever made a snow angel? 'Tis all new to me. Belt, I remember making snow angels on Dartmoor, face up to the sky, lying on the cold ground. Annie, I hope to fly Thursday, get in Friday, but apparently there's another storm on the way. It's incredibly beautiful, especially on the industrial landscape of the lake, which looks like the sea, huge. Belt, it was like trying to fall off the earth. Sounds incredible. Immense landscapes. I haven't seen the sky since Mirzani. One definition of community is a group of people who care about each other more than they have to. This isn't a business exchange, even remotely. It is conversation, the verbal glue binding people separated by geography into a community. Chat's important to us corporate types because it's a medium where it's almost impossible to operate within the old rules. Because chat is a live medium, there's little leeway for faking a voice, for a sophist approximation of a person. You can adopt a new persona, but you're going to need to button it all the way up and live it, or we'll be able to tell there's someone else underneath. Chat is CB radio on steroids. It's immediate and unwashed. If you can't type and think at the same time, you're in deep weeds. We can't broadcast, can't message, can't spew corporate pablum in a chat environment. If business could successfully integrate chat into its marketing universe, companies would be on their way to shaking off some of the mass media shackles separating them from customers. One of the more interesting uses of a chat service has been to provide live customer support for websites without resorting to expensive telephone call centers. LivePerson.com is selling a service using a pop-up chat client connected to a 24/7 call center to provide live, on-the-spot support to web customers. Each support rep can field up to 4 simultaneous chat sessions. Customers get an immediate, interactive support person to answer their questions. Constantine. Hi there, Rick. What can I help you with today? Rick. Hi, Constantine. Could you tell me if your service can work with query string tokens instead of cookies? Constantine. Can I just clarify what you are asking? Are you looking to track users using query strings? Rick. No, I need a solution that works even if a person refuses to accept cookies, or if their firewall/browser rejects cookies. Constantine. Or are you referring to being a user and receiving a cookie when you begin to chat? Rick. Yep. Constantine. If you hold on 1 second, I can find out for you. Rick. Great, thanks. Constantine. I'm sorry, but it is not possible right now to offer the service without sending cookies. Rick. Ah, is it planned? Constantine. Just a moment, please. Constantine. Not at the present time. Rick. Okay, thanks for taking the time. Constantine. Thanks for visiting. There's none of the hit-or-miss multi-day waiting we get with email support, no phone cost to the customer or vendor. Commerce sites have reportedly been experiencing dramatically increased sales from the high-touch attention they can give their customers. Chat forces us to be human and fully present, except for those of us who start out as gorillas. Hello, my baby. Welcome, Dr. Patterson and Coco. We're so happy you're here. Dr. P. Patterson. You're welcome. Hello, my baby. Is Coco aware that she's chatting with thousands of people now? Live Coco. Good here. Dr. P. Patterson. Coco is aware. Hello, my baby. I'll start taking questions from the audience now. Our first question is, MLNY Kitty asks, Coco, are you going to have a baby in the future? Live Coco. Pink. Dr. P. Patterson, we've had earlier discussion about colors today. Live Coco. Listen, Coco loves eat. Hello, my baby. Me too. Dr. P. Patterson, what about a baby? She's thinking. Live Coco. Unattention. Dr. P. Patterson, she covered her face with her hands, which means it's not happening, basically, or it hasn't happened yet. Live Coco. I don't see it. No, I didn't make it up. Worried about 800-pound media gorillas dominating the net? Web pages. The web lets us look into other people's lives in an intimate way. It enables us to see people as they are, close up. Have you ever been browsing for information, read an interesting page, followed the author's name link, and tripped through his personal pages, read his badly written poetry, looked at pictures of his dog, cat, family, friends, and trip to the Bahamas? For instance, while browsing slashdot.org, I read a comment from Chris Worth, followed a breadcrumb trail to chrisworth.com, and was captivated by his personal web phantasmagoria, including a cogent comparison of users of Microsoft productivity tools to frogs in pots of heating water and a scary little piece about his view of helicopters. Another time, I searched for how-to information about a software program I was installing, found an article written by Glenn Fleischman, clicked on his byline link to glens.org, and was engrossed in his story of how he fought Hodgkin's disease and won. I do this frequently. In my mind's eye, I watch myself clicking off my intended path, wondering what the draw is. Why am I allowing myself to be diverted from my goal? It's because I enjoy listening to people. They give me windows into their lives, providing substance as a foil to the superficial factual gloss of their day jobs. I'm seduced into spending time staring at evidence of their humanity, despite my better judgment against such a waste of time. And then I do it again, and again. Early on in Sun's exploration of the web, our best site efforts came from small teams with broad skills who didn't have too many constraints placed on what they were supposed to create. They had to work quickly and invent solutions to problems nobody had ever faced before, Perhaps because of the variety of skills the team had to integrate and the short timelines, customers said they thought the sites looked like the result of people having fun and moving quickly. We never had time to corporatize them. The fact that web pages are conversations hasn't sunk in because they look like publications, but they are conversations, expressions of individual voice looking for response. The web pages we revisit often have feedback mechanisms and change over time in response to that feedback. Further, they must change visibly or people won't come back. We expect change, reaction, reflection of our comments, and feedback. This is not just true with respect to personal web pages. There's a very strong desire for corporate web pages to have a human feel, to speak to us in some genuine way. This desire cries out for communication that's less formal, less professional, less anonymous, and more for the people reading than for the company doing the writing. Hart Scientific Incorporated, hartscientific.com, posted a convenient comparison of conversational versus traditional writing on their website. They have two versions of their Y2K compliance page. You can tell them apart. Non-compliance issues could arise if Hart Scientific manufactured products are combined with other manufacturers' products. Hart cannot test all possible system configurations in which Hart manufactured products could be incorporated. Our products currently test as being compliant and will continue to operate correctly after January 1, 2000. However, customers must test integrated systems to see if components work with Hart Scientific manufactured products. Hart makes no representation or warranty concerning non-Hart manufactured products. And if you're using our equipment with someone else's gear, who the hell knows what's going to happen? We sure don't. So how can we promise you something specific, or even vague for that matter? We can't, so we won't. However, we love our customers, and like always, we'll do whatever is reasonable to solve whatever problems come up, if there are any. We seem to know, intuitively, when something spoken, written, or recorded is sincere and honest, when it comes from another person's heart, rather than being a synthesis of corporate speak filtered by myriad iterations of editing, trimming, and targeting. There's an inherent pomposity in much of what passes for corporate communication today. Missing are the voice, humor, and simple sense of worth and honesty that characterize person-to-person conversation. We survived Y2K, but that's not the biggest challenge we face. The need for honest speech to ordinary people hasn't gone away. Web-savvy consumers are ignoring online brochures. An organization, as presented via the web, must have a human voice, must stand for something, mean something, want to meet people, and show they're trying to understand those people. Millions and millions served. How do you scale one-to-one networking to reach thousands and millions of like-minded netizens? Sure, I could do it with a phalanx of smart people reaching out and touching electronically, but then my fledgling company's burn rate would increase faster than I could raise capital. Where is the balance there? Seems like any mass-produced message, even tailored for a given market, will be disingenuous to the savvy. Jody Lentz, email to cluetrain.com. Is having conversations with lots of constituents really practical? Yes. Our conversations are already reaching more customers than we know. People have other means of hearing conversations besides talking to us directly. They can eavesdrop on conversations we have with others by reading other people's email posted to the web or by reading posts in newsgroups. The volume of conversation about us we don't participate in directly is almost always greater than the volume we are personally involved in. We respond not only to the honesty and integrity of our conversations on the net, but also to those indicators of integrity in other people's conversations. Our choice was never to be in all the conversations, but to be honest and open in those we do engage in. Companies will survive employees telling their truths, their stories in a business context, without instituting draconian controls on their ability to speak out when and to whom they please. We listen to individuals differently than we do to organizational speech. When a company publishes PR, it's trying to give us a complete message about who they are and what they do. We have to decide to trust or distrust the company based on a single statement. Well-written PR leaves us with few avenues for corroboration and second opinions. It's meant to be self-contained. On the other hand, when I converse with people inside a company, I hear stories from individuals. They're all grains of sand, their combined voices richer and more diverse than the univocal speech of corporate mouthpieces. We add up all the anecdotes we hear from individuals. We have to trust our own averaging, our own summing of stories, our own divining of truth. With more people, more stories in the mix, it's harder for one negative story to sway me. This speaks to the need to have many people in an organization talking to customers. A single corporate story is a fiction in a world of free conversation. Corporate stories, like corporate cultures, are informed by individuals over time through many contacts, conversations, and opportunities to tell stories. There is no longer a single source for the truth. You can no longer download the corporate PR campaign as reality and go from there. You are now hearing many voices, many truths, and will have to pick and choose and integrate. A company's fear is that a lone voice with an axe to grind will make up a truth as plausible as anything the marketing department has come up with, but harmful to the company, and it'll be adopted as the truth, irrespective of the facts. The reality is that when malicious propaganda happens, and it will happen, the truth will out. That is the glorious thing about the markets of opinion. No opinion stands unchallenged. This is the real fear many corporations have of the markets of opinion, that their white propaganda, they are the Galahads of the industry, pure and good and perfect, will also not survive the challenges of the market of opinions. They're right, they won't. Cope. The corporations will be revealed to be made up of fallible human beings, just like us. Brian Hurt, email to cluetrain.com. Stories play a large part in the success of organizations. With stories, we teach, pass along knowledge of our craft to colleagues, and create a sense of shared mission. Will coordinating what a large number of people have to say be a problem? Yes and no. The problem is not in the effort required to coordinate voices, but in the attitude that assumes speech demands coordination and control. A culture of storytelling, one encouraging the collection and sharing of knowledge in conversation, may need encouragement and example setting, but it will certainly fail in the face of attempted restraint. There's legal risk in freer communication between employees and customers. Companies accustomed to issuing pronouncements from a single, tightly controlled department find this conversational shift somewhat terrifying. The intersection of the webbed world with business as usual leaves much legal ground uncharted. While we're waiting to see how our laws will evolve to meet these realities, it might be prudent for companies to consider which is more damaging, silence or talking to customers in many individual voices. Is the legal risk posed by unfettered speech always a valid excuse for not speaking? When we were building Sun's first Intel-based workstation, the 386i, we used mock magazine reviews of the product as a way to test ideas for the design of the computer and the software. As the design progressed, we settled on one review as an example of a magazine article that might appear when the product shipped. The ersatz review was a hit with team members. It became a decision yardstick for months of subsequent design and implementation questions. People also started giving copies of the review to customers and using it as a conversation starter with friends and colleagues in other companies. The review wasn't a product pitch. It required a person to deliver it, explain it, and fill in lots of details. It wasn't a data sheet, but a foil for stories and conversations. Its value was not in creating some kind of official spin, but in enabling the reliable transfer of knowledge and new ideas. Here's a definition of that pesky and borderline elitist phrase, knowledge worker. A knowledge worker is someone whose job entails having really interesting conversations at work. The characteristics of conversations map to the conditions for genuine knowledge generation and sharing. They're unpredictable interactions among people speaking in their own voice about something they're interested in. The conversants implicitly acknowledge they don't have all the answers, or else the conversation is really a lecture, and risk being wrong in front of someone else. And conversations overcome the class structure of business, suspending the org chart, at least for a little while. If knowledge management aims at making organizations smarter, and that in turn means increasing the quality of conversations, can we please avoid the temptation to create something called conversation management? David Weinberger. A critical aspect of success with large numbers of customers lies in listening to them. It's not enough for employees to talk to customers. There must be a way for the fruits of employee conversations to trickle back into an organization's plans. When Sun started to address the problem of providing technical support to the Java developer community, we made a glaring error. We assumed our answers to technical questions were more valuable than answers from sources outside our group, than answers from our customers. Sun's first launch of the Java Developer Connection website was an unabashed effort to package a fairly sleazy business proposition, selling per-incident support for a poorly supported and less than adequately documented software product. We were doing a lousy job of helping Java developers. A bright marketing wag had the idea to sell people answers to their questions for $100 a pop. When a licensing engineer who dealt with customers day in and day out posed the question, "Why should they feel good about paying us for answers that should be in the docs or for consulting on problems caused by the instability of our products?" the marketing folks decided to use a bit of sugarcoating. For $495 a year, a customer could purchase a subscription including 5 questions called Support Incidents and a package including technical newsletters and other goodies. Unfortunately, the marketing team focused on providing the $100 support answers and didn't spend much time setting up the information publishing pipeline for the sugarcoating. We had fewer than 200 paying customers for the service. Almost all used up their magic answers in less than a month, then started clamoring for the real value, the grossly understaffed information subscription that was to be their pipeline to successful use of Java. To add insult to injury, our own cross-divisional inefficiencies cost us $110 for each question answered. You do the math. Time for phase two. We shut down the site and relaunched a free service with a few critical new features. The staffing problem hadn't gotten better, so we brainstormed ideas for getting the Java community to help us solve their problems. We now have a free site with question and answer forums where developers answer each other directly. We added a tap into Sun's Java software bug database and provided a means for developers to add their own notes and workarounds to our bug information, as well as vote for the bugs they wanted us to fix soonest. A reverse pipeline into the company sent the bug votes to our engineers to help with prioritization. The site hit 1 million registered members in 2 years, a far cry from the 200 in 6 months that the initial, traditional support efforts yielded. Moreover, the site became a nexus for conversations about our products and services, and for conversations about other people's solutions to our problems. Symantec took a similarly creative approach when they first launched their Cafe product, a suite of programming tools for Java developers. They had one person virtually living in the public support news groups. He responded to questions, fielded tech support requests, and generally got himself known as a very straight shooter about Symantec's products. He was only one person, but he was almost single-handedly responsible for the developer community's positive take on Symantec. He wasn't there to promote, but strictly to assist. He gave honest answers to hard questions, acknowledged product shortcomings, and painted an honest, open picture of the product's strengths and weaknesses. The developer community's collective opinion of Symantec soared. Another anecdote from the public relations history of Sun's Java team paints an anti-example. In the first year and a half that Sun's Java group existed, members of the engineering team spoke directly with customers and the press. Java grew from a glimmer, a possibility, to a platform with thousands of curious, turned-on early adopters. There was a general perception that Sun's Java team listened, answered questions, and was actively engaged with the community of Java developers. After about 18 months, the workload grew to such a point that we started shutting down our channels to the outside world. PR and marketing took over much of our contact with the outside world, and we put our heads down to deal with the increasing demands on the engineering team. The reaction from our developers was stated in these precise words many times over: "You disappeared." As we went underground, the perception of the Java group in the marketplace changed from a small team of great engineers producing neat stuff to a hype engine to push Sun's stock. In projects that allowed engineers time to come back online more often, customers cut the engineers far more slack in their attempts to get things right than did the customers of their more closed-mouthed brethren. In such scenarios, of course, engaging in trivial conversations can chew up valuable time, though it's a tough call to know what's truly trivial and what deepens credibility in the conversational space. Sometimes responding to a joke with a one-line email laugh can do wonders. We still need to answer all the mail, but we can do things to eliminate some of the more repetitious communication. Generally, people inclined to find answers themselves will seek out a live person when they want one, based on their own needs and ideas. Most of us would rather not be forced into a conversation by inadequate access to key product information. Investment in learning from the one-on-one conversations we have and adding to the public knowledge base founded on that learning pay off in freeing up time to have more interesting conversations. I've seen reductions of up to 75% in support email traffic simply by creating informative lists of frequently asked questions, FAQs, and making people aware of them at the point where they're likely to be scratching their heads over a particular type of question, making certain, of course, the new content isn't written in corporate speak. I try to spread the burden of dealing with customer conversations throughout an organization. I make everyone spend some time answering questions from customers. Not only do I mine everyone's budget for the support costs, let's face it, by the time I'm trying to find money to answer the mail, it's too late, but I also give everyone involved a tap into our customers' heads. It results in a lot more shared awareness of our mission, strengths, and opportunities. There are two kinds of FAQs, I realized recently. One, those that frame questions the company wants you to ask. Question: so how good are your products anyway? Answer: very, very, very good. And two, those that acknowledge actual problems and provide solutions. The one variety is bullshit PR, while two is truly useful. Christopher Locke. Silence is fatal. Online markets will talk about companies whether companies like it or not. People will say whatever they like without caring whether they're overheard or quoted. In fact, having one's views passed along is usually the whole point. Companies can't stop customers from speaking up and can't stop employees from talking to customers. Their only choice is to start encouraging employees to talk to customers and empowering them to act on what they hear. Freed from restrictions perceived as an unwelcome straitjacket and are ultimately unenforceable anyway, workers can generate enormous goodwill as everyday evangelists for products and services they've crafted themselves and thus take genuine pride in. I've spent the last 2 years bringing fire to the cavemen in the corporate world, specifically fashion. They still don't understand the difference between a server, a browser, and content, but they do understand that they have to be online. They think that a computer is just like a television, that you can just scan some glossy print ads and throw them up on a site. No one cares about usability. No one cares about being real. They're scared that if they don't make the jump to internet marketing / selling, that they'll lose their customer loyalty. They're scared that if they do make the jump to internet marketing / selling, that they'll lose their customer loyalty. They ask themselves, is this really us? Is technology part of our lifestyle / branding concept? They say they don't market to that demographic, but they know deep down inside that if they don't soon, they won't have anyone to market to. Sometimes I just want to scream. Kimberly Peterson, email to cluetrain.com. Customer loyalty is not a commodity a company owns. Where it exists at all, and the cases in which it does are rare, loyalty to a company is based on respect. And that respect is based on how the company has conducted itself in conversations with the market. Not conversing, participating, is not an option. If we don't engage people inside and outside our organization in conversation, someone else will. Start talking. Chapter 4. Markets Are Conversations by Doc Searles and David Weinberger. When you think of the internet, don't think of Mack trucks full of widgets destined for distributorships whizzing by countless billboards. Think of a table for two. At Man. It was April in Paris, several weeks before a big press conference where my client, a large but rapidly shrinking French computer company, would roll out a wonderful new computer, the first of its kind. The whole project had been veiled in secrecy for years. Security was intense. Code names were used. Deep alliances with big players were mentioned only in hushed tones. The company had hired me to develop a strategy for the rollout. In particular, they wanted a message, one that would serve as a tagline for the event and for all the advertising to follow. A meeting of the company's marketing communications people was convened for my analysis of the market and a briefing on a strategy that would make the press conference great. The assignment was painfully hopeless. Oh, the new computer was nice and the usual customers would buy it, but the larger market, the one this company needed to penetrate, could care less. The company had been too silent too long. With nothing to lose, I told them the truth. We have three problems, I began. First, there is no market for your message, least of all among journalists who want facts and stories. Second, there is no market for your secrecy. You have long ignored the market, now they will choose to ignore you. Third, there really is no market for your press conference. Journalists want to be briefed exclusively. They stared at me. I continued. Markets are nothing more than conversations. See these magazines? They're a form of market conversation. We should already be in their stories. We are key to the subject, but we're missing in action after working in secret for years. Our only hope is to talk, starting now. I outlined a strategy for igniting as much conversation as possible in a very short time, suggesting some fun, creative, and ultimately pointless ideas. Later, a dozen people came up and thanked me for telling the truth and giving them new hope, although presumably for their next jobs. Then the project manager took me aside and said, "That was brilliant. Now, what's the tagline?" First things last. The first markets were markets, not bulls, bears, or invisible hands, not battlefields, targets, or arenas, not demographics, eyeballs, or seats, most of all, not consumers. The first markets were filled with people, not abstractions or statistical aggregates. They were the places where supply met demand with a firm handshake. Buyers and sellers looked each other in the eye, met, and connected. The first markets were places for exchange, where people came to buy what others had to sell, and to talk. The first markets were filled with talk. Some of it was about goods and products, some of it was news, opinion, and gossip. Little of it mattered to everyone, all of it engaged someone. There were often conversations about the work of hands. Feel this knife, see how it fits your palm. The cotton in this shirt, where did it come from? Taste this apple. We won't have them next week. If you like it, you should take some today. Some of these conversations ended in a sale, but don't let that fool you. The sale was merely the exclamation mark at the end of the sentence. Market leaders were men and women whose hands were worn by the work they did. Their work was their life, and their brands were the names they were known by. Miller, Weaver, Hunter, Skinner, Farmer, Brewer, Fisher, Shoemaker, Smith. For thousands of years, we knew exactly what markets were, conversations between people who sought out others who shared the same interests. Buyers had as much to say as sellers. They spoke directly to each other without the filter of media, the artifice of positioning statements, the arrogance of advertising, or the shading of public relations. These were the kinds of conversations people have been having since they started to talk, social, based on intersecting interests, open to many resolutions, essentially unpredictable, spoken from the center of the self. Markets were conversations doesn't mean markets were noisy. It means markets were places where people met to see and talk about each other's work. Conversation is a profound act of humanity. So once were markets. The industrial interruption. The advent of the industrial age did more than just enable industry to produce products much more efficiently. Management's approach to production and its workers was quickly echoed in its approach to the market and its customers. The economies of scale they were gaining in the factory demanded economies of scale in the market. By the time it was over, we had forgotten the one true meaning of the market and replaced it with industrial substitutes. In The Third Wave, Alvin Toffler wrote that the rise of industry drove an invisible wedge between production and consumption, a fact Friedrich Engels had noticed over 100 years earlier. As production was ramped up to unheard-of rates, the clay pot of craftwork was broken into shards of repetitive tasks that maximized efficiency by minimizing difference, interchangeable workers creating interchangeable products. In the market, consumption also needed to be ramped up, not just to absorb the increased production of goods, but also to promote people's willingness to buy the one-size-fits-all products that rolled off mass production lines. And management wasted little time noticing the parallels in efficiencies they could achieve all along the production-consumption chain. If products and workers were interchangeable, then interchangeable consumers began to look pretty good, too. The goal was simple. Customers had to be convinced to desire the same thing, the same Model T in any color, so long as it's black. And if workers could be better organized through the repetitive nature of their tasks, so customers were more easily defined by the collective nature of their tastes. Just as management developed a new organizational